Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. So I have to tell you, I was so drawn to the real life subject of today's show that it was a no-brainer. I had to talk to the author, Brad Ricker. But before I introduce Brad, let me tell you a little bit about the subject of today's show. Olive MacLeod, she was a 30-year-old redhead, a Scottish socialite, the life of every party she went to, and she was newly engaged to the handsome naturalist Boyd Alexander. But in 1910, shortly after their engagement, Olive's whole world changed when her fiancé disappeared in Africa. So what did she do? Well, she did what few women of her time would attempt. She set out on a 3,000-plus-mile journey to find him, traversing lands where few, if any, white women had been seen before. The name of the book is Olive the Lionheart, Lost Love, Imperial Spies, and One Woman's Journey into the Heart of Africa. Let me tell you a little about my guest, Brad Ricker. He's appeared in documentaries on the History Channel and AMC. He's been a guest on shows such as Criminal, All Things Considered, and BBC Radio. He says he enjoys stories where the real meets the imaginary and has authored several books, including Mrs. Sherlock Holmes. Again, the name of the book, Olive the Lionheart, and here's my guest, Brad Ricker. Brad Ricker, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Vicki.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. Instantly, I was grabbed by the title of the book, which is Olive the Lionheart, but also I am fascinated by women who went on extraordinary journeys, especially back, you know, in the early 1900s. But before we dive into the story, Brad, I'd like just to share a little bit more about you with our listeners, since it's the first time we've talked. And I saw on your site you say, I'm not a journalist or historian, or maybe even a biographer. I am a writer who wants to tell unconventional stories that haven't been told before, usually about people who are somewhat invisible and imperfect. So tell us a little bit about how you came across Olive the Lionheart, as you call her, and what compelled you to turn this into one of your stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's always kind of a mix of luck and kind of looking more broadly at things just I want to write about. I mean, there's a selfish part to this, too, that when you sit down and say, oh, I'm going to start a new book, it's a big commitment, and I like to do things that I'm really interested in, because then I know I'll finish it. So I wanted to write about race. I wanted to write about escape and adventure and travel because I was kind of stuck at home at the time with some little kids who kind of showed up. And I looked around and looked through newspapers and I just stumbled really on this article of this woman, Olive MacLeod, who her fiancé is lost in Africa. He's a handsome naturalist, and she goes to find him, and it had this illustration of her, you know, riding an elephant off into Africa, and I thought, well, this can't be true, and I looked a little, and it, sure enough, it was, and of course, that was the only story. There was no story the day after, so I knew I kind of had this hunch that there was a bigger story to be told.
Mm. And so you decide to take this story on, and where do you even begin to do the research on it?
Well, it was hard because no one had really written about her. So I started newspapers, and I eventually found that she had written a book that had, you know, of course, was long out of print and long disappeared, but I was able to find it. About her adventures, so this was a huge resource for me. But then I found different things like her fiance who she goes after, his name was Boyd Alexander, and he too had written some books, and he too had a diary, which was really great. And so I wrote it and pulled together from all these different sources, some government sources and different, some things I found in France. And then I was almost done with the manuscript, and I found out that she herself had diaries. And I found that they were in a castle on the Isle of Skye in Scotland. You can't make this stuff up, right?
Right, right. And it's a beautiful island, but beautiful island.
Oh, yeah. And I looked up, how can I get there? There was like 15 different train transfers and a couple boats. And I got in touch with the curator there. I said, I'm writing this book, and I'd like to use these diaries. And he said, well, you can visit us, but the visit just wasn't going to happen because there was another new kid who had just shown up.
I like how they just show up in your house.
they just like appear out of nowhere. They were great enough to, send me copies of the diaries, and I instantly knew that though I had one story all mapped out of her adventure, there was an entirely different layer to it, and that was the story of what she was going through while she went to Africa.
Right. And let's dive into that in just a second. I want to begin with how you began the book, because you began it with the most beautiful fairy tale. I got so engrossed in this fairy tale, I didn't want it to end. Although I really enjoyed the rest of the book, just to be clear on that, okay? but she grew up with her sister, Flora. When she met her fiancé, she did not tell anyone but her sister about him. Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I think there was hesitance, as to maybe what she felt about him. She's very straightforward in her diaries, but it's also 1910, so she's maybe not as straightforward sometimes as we think people are in their diaries. So I don't know why she didn't tell him. Maybe she was just keeping something to herself. Like you said, they had a very sisterly relationship that was pretty competitive at times, and some words being exchanged and backstabbing. But of course, they loved each other. I think she was just kind of, and she was unsure herself, whether she liked this guy or not.
Right. So in 1910, she decides to go. Boyd Alexander, the naturalist, has gone off to Africa on this expedition. They get engaged, and shortly after, he leaves for this trip, which he'd been planning, obviously, for a long time. And his plan is to return to Olive MacLeod a year later. And, of course, he doesn't. And so in 1910, she sets off to find her missing fiancé. Great name, by the way, his name, Boyd Alexander. It would be, straight out of a fiction plot, right?
Yeah.
But, of course, we're talking real characters here. And she goes off on this journey, which in itself was very unusual in those times for a woman to go traveling. In fact, before she even leaves England, she's in Liverpool, and the shopkeeper tells her, turn around and go home, you're going to die, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary that she goes, for one. It's also extraordinary to me that they let her go, which is a very sexist thing to say, but it's a very sexist environment. She eventually convinces her father, and he pays for the trip. And she gets an experienced couple, the Talbots, who have traveled to Africa, and Mr. Talbot holds a post in Nigeria, and they agree to take her, and she sets off for Africa, even though people are, just as you said, she goes to buy some film, and the shopkeeper says, if you go, you will never return, you will die. And I think she takes this as kind of a challenge, and just, gets on the boat and goes.
Right, and I think the thing that surprised me too was she really hadn't known the Talbots very long. I mean, it's kind of risky business going with people you've not known long on such an arduous journey there.
Yeah, and I think that a little bit of that is that's just Olive.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, she doesn't know Boyd Alexander all that long before, and you're right, that name is terrific, and you've got to see the photo of him. He's, you know, he has the mustache, and he's an ex-soldier, and he very much looks like a Boyd Alexander. But she doesn't know him that long, and they, you know, get together, and she doesn't know the Talbots nearly at all, and she goes. And I think that's just part of her personality that maybe didn't have a lot of daylight in the social world of London, but on this journey and this exploration, you know, she has kind of an unlimited horizon to explore that.
Right, right. And so she begins this journey. It's around 3,000 miles in a nine-month period, which again in those days was quite some land to cover. You know, every terrain you can think of, she pretty much went through, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people now that are reading it are telling me, well, it's like the African Queen. They're on a boat for a little bit, but then they start walking, and then they're on horses. But like you said, they're going through swamps, they're going through desert at one point, and forest and jungle and grasses and rocks and canyons. It sort of never ends. It's a greatest hits of African geography and wildlife for them.
Yeah, and I mean, it's quite an adventure story all the way through, you know, adventure of the heart, if you will, adventure of the mind, the spirit, and of course the physical adventure there too. I'm wondering if when you were putting this together, did you have a favorite story of the adventure itself?
Yeah, I mean, the favorite story, I really love that you mentioned it before, the story of the fairy flag, which doesn't take place in Africa, but I really wanted to include that because to set the tone of what she goes through in Africa is very much real. It happened, but there's a slight tinge of the unreal to it. There are things that happen that sometimes don't make sense or you know, even border on the supernatural, but it all happened. So I think my favorite story, there's a lot. They're so different, and I'm continually astounded by the different things she did. I really like the story of her discovering the waterfall. There's a waterfall in French territory, and they've heard it. They know it's there. They're looking for a way to connect the rivers, but none of the natives will go near it because there's a legend that there's a devil that lives there. And Olive, of course, hears it, and she says, and she writes this to herself in the diary, she says, I want to be the one to discover that waterfall. And she gets really competitive. So their party sets off, and she's so competitive about it that people start dropping left and right. Mrs. Talbot hurts her ankle and has to go back, and their guides have to go back, and they run into all these bad things, baboons and snakes, but she presses forward, and she indeed discovers this waterfall, and the French name it after her. And it's really incredible because she doesn't get credit for it now. I mean, you can't even find that she's done it. Only in the early maps is it named after her.
Right, right. And so what do you think kept her going? I mean, obviously she's a different kind of person. She's very determined. You know, she reminds me of kind of a Jane Austen character, if you will, but she had a real purpose here. What do you think was her innermost driving factor that kept her going?
I think that's the real question of the book. And that was the question for me in going through her life, because this was the first person who in whose life I was writing about where I had an actual day-to-day diary of her innermost thoughts. And what I found was she had the, it's very much like, I keep using this analogy just because I can't find a better one, to be honest. It's a little like Facebook, where people go on Facebook and say, everything's great. We're outside, we're barbecuing, the sun is shining. But you know, everyone isn't great. It's
right.
2020, and there's a lot of bad things happening, and to many people, really bad things have happened or are happening. So Olive writes this story of her adventures, and there's danger and there's peril, but it's generally very positive. But then the story in her diaries is that she's going through trauma in dealing with the loss of Boyd, and as she goes through Africa, as you said, you called it a journey of a heart of the heart, which I think is really nice. They should have put that on the cover. That she doesn't know really if she knows him as well as she thinks she does. And the real question for me became, well, why does she go to Africa in the first place? Is she really looking for him, or did she have another agenda or another plan? And I can't say for sure, but I suggest in the book, and I think she suggests in herself, that she did have another reason for going, at least initially.
Yeah, one thing I want to point out, because the book is so well written. I mean, it just drew me straight through, right from that very first fairy story that I said I didn't want to end, but, you know, I just kept going. And you say in the author notes, you say you don't know how she got through this part of her life and you don't want to speculate. You write that she's neither a savior nor a victim, but she's courageous. And one of the things that I think makes the book so compelling, Brad, is that you really wanted Olive to tell her own story as much as possible in her own words, with her own voice. And there are times that you actually use excerpts or language directly from her diaries, which I think gives it a much more authentic feel. And I feel that I quite, you know, I got to know her much better than I would have done if you had not used that. And also the letters that you share between Boyd Alexander and Olive MacLeod. I mean, I couldn't stop reading them. They're really compelling. So when you are putting something together like that, as a writer, how do you, I mean, what, first of all, I know you have a sense of obligation to tell the story to the truth as possible, but how do you, what kind of obligation did you feel to Olive MacLeod when you were writing this?
Yeah, I mean, she was constantly in my thoughts, more so than with any other subject, because there's a line she says, Mr. Talbot's talking to her. They're out in the brush, and he says, you know, you should write this down. You should write a book of this someday. And she just laughs and she says, oh, the horror of, you know, people actually reading it. And that line haunted me, because here I am printing some of her letters and diaries, and actually a very small amount of, I mean, she has tons of this stuff. And so that, in the beginning, I said, you know, just like you said, do I have, you know, should I, how do I feel about this? But then I thought, you know, she does say that she's kind of horrified that people would read about her story. But then as soon as she gets home, she writes a book and sells it and publishes it. So I can't be too, I wasn't too worried about it. And there's also the idea that, you know, diaries are for an audience. And her diaries, she never destroyed them. And to me, that does mean something. I've studied Emily Dickinson for a long time, and she left her all of her poetry to be found, and she knew it would be found.
Mm-hmm.
And Olive, you know, Olive, I think, left it for her sister to find. And they weren't destroyed. So I think, more so than anything, I think, I'm not really answering your question, I promise I will, but more so than anything, I knew that her story would resonate with people. I think there's an easy version of her story where she goes to Africa and runs from the lions and discovers waterfalls and all that, that great stuff. But I think if you keep this part out of it, the stuff she goes through, then it's not truthful. And it's not nearly as powerful. So I think her story, my hope is that her story can help people who are going through similar things. As to how I organized it, it was really, really difficult because I really knew that the only way someone like me could tell this story was to get out of the way and let her tell it. That was the only way, with all of these different things in play, a story about Africa, a story about a woman in 1910 that I had to disappear. So I tried to let her tell the story as much as possible, and she is such a good writer that I tried to put her own words in as much as possible. And the letters, too, I think just to present the letters as is, I'm a big fan of the book Possession, along with everybody else in the universe. And, you know, that has those great chapters of just letters. And I kept telling my editor, like, let's do it like Possession. Let's do it. And they were like, this isn't really... but I'm glad we're able to do it this way because you get an inside view of their relationship. And you also get, because what happens is she sends letters, and because he's in Africa, there's a disconnect. Is she'll send like four letters and he'll get one and respond to the one, and she won't know which one he's responding to. And you get this, you can see it in real time, this kind of breakdown of communication between them. And I really wanted to show that because I think that's what happens in lots of relationships. But even you don't have to be traveling to Africa, but it's happening here to them, and how she kind of mends that or holds on to some other kind of connection.
Yes, and it also brings home to you the time, the period, because they addressed each other even though they were engaged as... you know, Miss McLeod and Mr. Alexander. So,
yeah, it's really, I love the letters because there's one point in the letters where they're still in London and they're writing letters to each other.
And
he says, well, I ran into you the night before on my way from the British Museum in the snow. And it's this like really romantic moment. And I read the letter, and I'm kind of like, Boyd, tell us what happened. And then I realized that nothing happened. That, you know, in real life, it was probably a tip of the hat, a hello, how are you? Where the real emotion happened was in the letters. That's where they would say what they were feeling and what they wanted, and even that was very reserved and guarded.
Yes, yes. And also in recreating Africa, you say that, again, you wanted to recreate, you know, not just Africa from the time, but Africa through Olive's experience. So what do you think her overall sense of Africa was?
I think what amazes me about her, too, among the so many things, the big list, is she goes there and she's not, even though she's going through all this grief and everything else, as soon as she hits the coast, she just absorbs it all. She doesn't kind of shuffle through in the background, let's get through this, this is an act of grief or mourning. She, every tribe they meet, she learns from. Every wildlife, every flower she wants to know the name of is everything she takes in. It's like a scientist does. It's like a naturalist does. But she adds another level to it that I haven't seen. And I read a lot of especially women explorers at the time, and none of them caught the things that she did, the colors, the music. She hears all this African music and tries to recreate it. She tries to learn the language and gets a lot better at it, though she's not perfect. She just absorbs it all. And I was, when I started this, I fully expected and was bracing myself for, you know, someone from 1910 going into Africa and acting like someone from 1910 going into Africa. And though that's certainly there, it's nowhere near what I thought it would be. Olive, I think, just absorbs it so much, and it's why she can't get enough of it.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering, it said it took you a long time to find the diaries themselves, and then you found them through the curator that you mentioned earlier. How did you guys go through those diaries? Because you didn't actually meet up with him in person, right?
No, and it was really kind of funny because he had to look for them, and the way it sounded like no one had ever gone through them before, and he started scanning them for me. I think he felt bad for me, and I was sitting at home with this new baby literally on my knee, and he would send me the scans over, and they would be coming at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning, whatever the time difference was, and I would be up with the baby. It was my turn, and we would kind of look at these together, and then he would say, like, you know, oh, you're not going to believe this one. So it was really kind of special, because at the end, he's like, you know, I've grown attached to Olive's missives, he called it. So what started as just kind of a research thing turned into, you know, really getting to know this person, and that's what I really wanted to do with the book. Someone who's been so forgotten. I mean, there's a lot of historical reasons to remember her, but I think just because of the person she was, she's just, you know, someone I think who's worth knowing.
Yeah, well, I love when I come across books like this because, you know, it always says, because of that one author, in this case you, this person's story has come to light. And there are so many fascinating stories out there that just don't come to light. So I'm wondering, as you're writing this, was there a particular part that was more difficult for you to write? And if so, why?
That's... really good question. I think they're all difficult.
Yes, writing's difficult.
Everybody knows that. Everybody's from third grade on, you know that writing's pretty tough. I think that the one I had the hardest time with, because there were a couple areas where I just didn't have a lot of information. And one is the end, and I don't want to spoil the end because there's a twist. I think there's a lot of twists in this book.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a part where she kind of comes to grips with why she's there. And like I said, she went through a lot of grief. And what we see in the letters is she wasn't letting anyone know about this. And I'm not a medical doctor, and I make no claims to be, but she was really depressed. And so I said, I'm not a doctor, and then, of course, I just diagnosed her. I can't stand when people diagnose real people, or even worse, as fictional people.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
I've heard so much of that. But she was going, let me rephrase it, that she was going through a really difficult time. And there's a point where she kind of has to make a decision. And that part was hard to write because it was really hard to get inside her head and, you know, try and deal with that like I know she was, because it's very strange. But for all the twinges of mysticism, or not even mysticism, but spirituality maybe, to this book, I felt like I was there, like in Olive's head, and trying to figure out what she was going to do next. And she had a choice to make. And as I say in the book, I don't know how she got through it, but she is amazing for having gotten through it.
She is very amazing, and I love the title of the book, Olive the Lionheart. I think it's absolutely perfect. Did you select that yourself, or?
Well, I wish I The funny thing is that I've never titled any of my books, and it's not, I don't think it's because I think I'm good with titles, but someone always suggests like the perfect one, and actually my agent came up with this one. He says, we're going to call it, I know I had a title in mind, and I can't even remember it because it must have been so horrendous, but he said Isle of the Lionheart, and I could see it on the cover. I mean, it's perfect.
Mm. Well, it's a truly fascinating story, very gripping, and as you said, there are twists throughout this story. And I know you say it, that you write at the end of the book, that, and you said this earlier in our conversation, that you hope that, you know, the reader, if they need it, can take something away from Olive's story that's helpful. And I think it's a really great book, so congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot coming from you.
Well, Brad Meltzer has been on our show many times, the author of The Lincoln Conspiracy, and he wrote Olive the Lionheart Has It All. Ricker mines emotions and real fears in this incredible true story, and I think that sums it up. So, Brad Ricker, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Vicki.
I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work and Olive the Lionheart at your website, olivethelionheart.com. And again, the book is Olive the Lionheart. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Brad?
Just I hope that everyone stays safe. And this is a good way to escape. But any book's a good way. I sound like a librarian now. Any book's a good way to escape. without having to leave the house.
Absolutely, and now is a good time to read.
Yeah.
Now is a good time to read. Have you found it's interfered with your productivity a lot, this COVID lockdown and what's going on in the world right now?
I don't know anyone who it hasn't interfered. I confess, in the beginning, as a writer, you know, there's the horror of it, and then, like, you know, make sure everybody's safe. But then there was a little part of me that's like, oh, I'm going to have time to write. As writers have to think that way. But I haven't had much time at all. I'm starting now. I'm working on something now and, you know, finding time between those small humans running around. yeah, it's tough, but it's always tough. You just have to find, there's, you know, we said writing's hard. You always have to make yourself do it.
Yep, that's very true. You got to dig deep and find that time.
Yeah,
and
yeah, you know.
Get your butt in the chair. That's the hardest part, is getting your butt in the chair. All right, well, Brad Ricker, thank you so much for being with us once again.
And thank you, Vicki.
Again, you can find out more about Brad at olivethelionheart.com. I want to thank everyone for joining us today, and I'm going to echo Brad's thoughts. You know, be safe out there, stay well, stay strong, and we will see you next week. You can find us at conversationslive.net. Until next week, stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.